row by row, gonna make this garden grow. All it takes is a rake and a hoe and a piece of fertile ground. And inch by inch and row by row, someone bless these seeds I sow. Someone warm them from below till the rains come and tumble them down.
Welcome to Digging In with Master Gardeners, a production of Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties. We are Teresa Golden and Jean Thomas, Master Gardener volunteers. We discuss gardening issues seasonally and describe the events and educational services we provide. The seasoning segments appear on a timely basis, according to what's happening in our gardens during the year. Outstanding in their field segments are an opportunity to introduce our most outstanding volunteers individually. Cross-pollinating stories will discuss the activities of master gardeners in additional roles. We have master foresters and master naturalists included in our membership, as well as master beekeepers. We even have brewmasters. There are other offerings available from Cooperative Extension, and we will periodically be chatting with representatives of the busy 4-H program and the Taste of New York market, as well as the various offerings for assistance with family life, from child care to budget planning. From time to time, we will go live for a call-in show when a particularly urgent topic arises. The podcast of Digging In with Master Gardeners is available through this station and via a link on our own website at ccecolumbiagreen.org/gardening.
Welcome to this edition of Digging In with Master Gardeners, a program from Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties. I'm Teresa Golden, and with me is Jean Thomas. We're both Master Gardener volunteers. We're happy that you've joined us for this special program. The topic for today is native and invasive plants. Joining us is another one of our Master Gardener volunteers, Tim Kenelty. Welcome, Tim.
Thank you.
I'm so glad you're here. So tell us a bit about your background and how you became interested in native and invasive plants.
Well, I have been a gardener all my life. My parents were gardeners. My grandfather had a huge vegetable and flower garden, and my ancestors from Ireland were potato farmers. So I kind of have gardening in the blood.
Wow, that's pretty impressive. Native plants, we hear, are often recommended as ideal garden plants because they're uniquely suited to growing in their native area. What are we really talking about when we say that a plant is native as opposed to non-native?
So that's a great question. Native plants are plants that have been here pretty much since pre-colonial times, so hundreds and thousands of years. So we're talking about like the oak tree in your forest or a coneflower out in your backyard. And because they're so important because they have co-evolved with the other species that were here for hundreds of years too. So the insects and the birds as well. Whereas non-native plants are plants that were brought here by humans, either intentionally or unintentionally. So they may have brought them here for commercial horticulture purposes, or maybe they came unintentionally as seeds in a crate that was shipped here, something like that.
So plants native to North America may not necessarily be native to New York. Do my plants need to be native to my town or my state?
It really depends on your point of view. You can go as hyperlocal as your county. So, for instance, there is a list of native plants to Columbia County that has been created by the Farmscape Ecology Project. But I'm a little bit broader when I look at native plants. I think it's really pretty much anything. I use anything pretty much in the Northeast. And it really needs to be something that is beneficial to insects or to birds. And I'll give you an example. I have a tree in my yard that's a beautiful tree. It's a red horse chestnut tree, and it's really not native to Columbia County or to New York State. It's native really to Pennsylvania and south of there. But it has these beautiful red tubular flowers in May, just about the time that the hummingbirds come back. And it's one of the only things that's blooming. And it's beneficial, and it's native to the Northeast, so I consider that a native.
Okay. On the time frame, you're talking about pre-colonial.
Right.
Is the time frame that people are considering native. So does that include the corn and the squash and the beans that the Indians were growing?
That's a great question. Some of those plants were native to a particular state or to a particular region, and the Native Americans did move a lot of that agriculture around. So we're really talking about things, though, that weren't brought here by Europeans.
Okay, that's a little bit more understandable for me. As far as native plants now, a lot of perennials are native to particularly the Midwest. Mm-hmm. Coneflowers,
right.
That whole plethora of things.
Yep.
Are those considered natives because we're a couple thousand miles?
Well, coneflowers are native to our area as well. Okay. They're native to Columbia and Greene counties. Something like bee balm is native in the Midwest, but also here. And there's plants that are native to Europe as well as to the U.S.
So why should I garden with native plants rather than introduced?
Gene, you're a master gardener. Why are you asking me that question?
That was rhetorical, Tim.
Well, the reason why you'd want to think about native plants is because they're really the foundation of the food web. And I'll give you an example. So something like an oak tree. An oak tree supports more than 500 different species of caterpillars. Why is that important? Because caterpillars turn into butterflies, but also because caterpillars are the main food of songbirds when they're nesting in the spring. So if you don't have oak trees, you don't have caterpillars and you don't have birds. So you really want to think about what you're planting and what you're not planting in your garden.
What's an easy way to get started to evolving my garden to include more native plants? Now, do you have specific suggestions?
Yeah, I mean, you probably have native plants in your garden already. I mean, if you have oak trees or maple trees in your forest, if you have phlox in your perennial garden, you probably already have natives. But what I would do is, you probably have a lot of non-natives too. If you're adding some perennials or a perennial bed, I just do a little bit of research. And it's a quick Google search to know if something's native or not. And just add it slowly, I would say. I mean, you don't really want to rip everything out, or you can certainly, but I don't suggest that to people. It's really about doing a little bit of research on what's a native and what's not a native.
So what are examples of typical native plants in this area?
So I talked about oak trees and maples. There's also birches and ashes. There's a lot of different native trees. There's also a lot of different native shrubs. There's some viburnums that are native that you would see, dogwood shrubs that you would see, as well as winter berries, those red berries when you're driving along in the winter that you see in kind of swampy areas. So there's lots and lots of different examples of natives that you would see if you're just driving along a county road.
What about perennials?
Yeah, sure. There's lots of different perennials that are native. Things like I've mentioned coneflowers, bee balm, garden phlox, mountain mint. There's lots and lots of different really beautiful natives that you can plant in your perennial garden.
Now, talking about the perennials, how much of a purist should you be? There's hybrids of all those things. The phlox, you can get the whole range of colors now in the, I can only think of the Latin name, bee balm. So is that discouraging? Should you not get hybrids?
Well, I try not to judge, period. I think if you're planting something that you like and that is, you know, a native cultivar, it's usually okay. It really depends on the plant. There are lots and lots of different colors and cultivars of bee balm, and they're pretty much all the same in terms of the beneficial qualities they have. But if you look at something like coneflowers, which have been bred and bred and bred, a lot of them, because they're bred for color, they bred out the pollen and they bred out the nectar. And so they're just not as beneficial to insects.
So where do I get native plants? I would go out and dig in my neighbor's yard, but he gets cranky.
Yeah, I think that's probably something you wouldn't want to do, Gene. Natives are much more accessible now. Most of the local garden centers will have natives. Sometimes they're labeled as native, sometimes they're not. There are specific nurseries that focus on natives. And I would say even the big box stores are starting to have native plants as well.
So a Google search prior to going would save you a whole lot of...
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. But I would say, look, almost anywhere you go these days, you can find native plants. It's really about you educating yourself as to what's a native and what isn't.
Do I need to take climate change into consideration when selecting native plants for my garden?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I think I think probably what you want to do first is just educate yourself as far as what's a native and what's not, because there's a lot to kind of sift through. There are some plants that if they're at the northern part of their range, like sugar maples, you may not want to plant just because as the climate changes, they may not be quite as adaptable. And the kind of good news, which is there's not a lot of good news about climate change, but we're probably going to be able to plant things and have things that are really more zone 6, zone 7, as we do have climate change.
So it's a scenario of if something's at the upper end of its zone.
Yeah,
you know,
I'd be hesitant. Like if you're planting a lot of trees, I probably wouldn't plant sugar maples or something that's more native to the Adirondacks, just because it's probably going to have struggle more.
Do you have a favorite native plant?
Oh, I have lots of favorite native plants. Well, I mentioned the red horse chestnut. I love bee balm, and the reason why I love bee balm is because it's great for hummingbirds, it's great for butterflies, and it is almost completely deer tolerant. And we have so many deer in this area. It's in the mint family, and deer, it's the one thing that I can pretty much say that the deer will not touch. There's a lot of things that people say are deer tolerant, and they're really not. They really don't touch bee balm.
Do they pretty much leave all the mints alone?
Yeah. I mean, it's about kind of the taste, I think, and a lot of times they have really fuzzy leaves, but it's more about, you know, they don't really like the taste of that.
We're talking with Master Gardener Tim Kenelty on Digging In with Master Gardeners from Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties. You can contact Cornell Cooperative Extension at ccecolumbiagreen.org or email us at colgremg@cornell.edu. So let's keep digging into this topic. We've talked a bit about native plants, and we want to kind of bridge now or segue into invasive plants. And so you've talked about natives and non-natives. Are all non-native plants considered invasive?
So we've talked about the really positive thing. Now we're going to get into the negative territory. Not all non-native plants are invasive. In fact, it's a pretty small subset of non-native plants. So something like a lilac bush in your backyard, it's not a native plant. It's probably not going to do a lot to support wildlife, but it's also not an invasive plant.
So how do I tell if something's invasive?
Well, if you have something in your yard that's kind of out of control and it's growing very quickly or spreading very rapidly, it's probably an invasive plant. They have very, very specific characteristics.
Well, I'll give you an example that I know is in my yard is Japanese stilt grass.
Yeah, that is a very invasive plant. The characteristics of invasive plants, they really out-compete native plants, and that's really one of the really detrimental things about invasive plants is they push out native plants. So they, for instance, Japanese stilt grass, it is a prolific seeder. It has really thousands of seeds. It's an annual. It's a prolific seeder. The seeds stay in the seed bed for many, many years. It's also called allelopathic, which means it puts out this chemical out of its roots that inhibits growth of other plants. So if you have that in your forest and the oaks are dropping acorns, they're probably not going to germinate because it's allelopathic. They also, if you're talking about an invasive shrub or an invasive tree, they usually are the first to leaf out in the spring. So if you're driving along a county road and you're seeing a lot of greenery in April, it's probably invasive shrubs, unfortunately. They are the last to keep their leaves. And I think the thing that makes them the most competitive is because they didn't co-evolve here with other species, they don't really have any natural enemies. They don't have any diseases that affect them generally because we plop them down here. They don't have any insects that affect them. Usually deer won't browse on them. So they have this huge, huge competitive advantage. And that's really kind of the definition of an invasive plant.
Okay. Why should our listeners who aren't gardeners, they live in an apartment, they have like a little lawn out front, why should they care?
Right. Well, if you're interested in wildlife at all, invasive plants are really detrimental to biodiversity, to a lot of different species in being in a particular area. Because if you take stilt grass as an example, it basically spreads so much that it creates kind of a monoculture. So there's nothing else there and becomes very, very sterile. But in addition to that, invasive plants really can be very harmful to agriculture, and invasive insects can be detrimental to agriculture. So for instance, stiltgrass or Canada thistle can really disrupt like organic farming. And then also they can be really harmful to humans and pets. So I'll give you an example of that. If you have barberry in your, Japanese barberry in your garden, and that has been sold really for many years. It was a big, big popular plant because it was a very tough plant. It also happens to be a plant that really supports ticks. So if you have big barberry bushes in your yard, they create this kind of very, very specific environment of humidity that there are usually 8 to 10 times as many ticks under that particular plant. So they can be really harmful to your health as well.
Well, one of our questions is, how did we get here and where did these plants come from? And you've answered part of that. I worked in the nursery industry for decades, and we were happily encouraging things like the barberry, mm-hmm. the euonymus, the floribunda rose. Mm-hmm. And now there's other ground covers that have become invasive yep. because they're so successful.
Yep.
So that's one answer. How else are they arriving?
Well, most terrestrial plants were brought here intentionally, and most for the horticulture industry. So Japanese knotweed was brought here because people thought it was beautiful and they planted it on estates. Garlic mustard, people thought was going to be a food crop, so they brought it here. So most terrestrial plants were brought here intentionally, whereas if the aquatic plants like purple loosestrife came here unintentionally. It probably came here with the colonists in ship ballast. So the seeds were probably in the water in the ship when they were letting the water out that got into the waterways of Massachusetts. In fact, that was prevalent in the 1800s. So the aquatic plants, a lot of them came here unintentionally.
So why is the purple loosestrife not considered native? It's been here since the colony.
It came with the colonists. So anything pre-colonists. They brought that unintentionally and it spread and it's been here a long, long time. But it's a non-native invasive plant.
Okay, and the beautiful reeds alongside the roads, they're lovely.
Phragmites,
yeah,
aren't they?
Yeah, same thing?
Yeah, it's one of those things, and I hate to say this, but it's like with Phragmites, there's so much of it that it's kind of like once you know about it, you can't unknow it, I say to people about invasive, so you're driving along, you're going to get kind of depressing, all of those Phragmites. Yeah, they came here unintentionally as well in ship ballast. They've been here quite a long time, and they do a huge amount of damage to ecosystems like marshy wetland ecosystems.
Like crowding out the cattail cycle?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. There's some good news about Phragmites, though. It's one of those plants, and one of the ways to combat invasive plants is through biocontrols. So, you know, there's different ways that you control invasives. You didn't ask me this, but I'm going to answer it anyway.
I didn't yet.
You can pull things, you can use herbicides, which you have to do very carefully, but there's also biocontrols, and that's kind of the future positive take on invasive plants, where what they're really doing is they're going back to where that plant came from and finding insect pests and diseases that really held back those plants. And so there are some biocontrols they're working on for Phragmites, like insects that really will kick it back. And that happened with purple loosestrife, where they brought some beetles over. Many, many years of study and a lot of money spent, but it's really starting to control the purple loosestrife.
And what about backfiring? If you bring something to control something and it becomes a pest on its own?
Yeah, I mean, that's why so much research has to be done and so much study. I mean, the purple loosestrife research was done for decades, a couple of decades before they really felt comfortable bringing something here they didn't think would, you know, harm other plants.
So until the biocontrols for Phragmites is really available,
right?
What does somebody do if they discover common weed on their property and they're trying to control it?
It's a really tough one. I mean, there's a couple of things you can do. You can mow, which is not terribly effective, but you can if the water level goes down. You can change the water levels. There are burning programs that work. There are some herbicides that you can use, but you would want to be very, very careful with herbicides because you're talking about wetland areas. I mean, it is one of the toughest ones to control.
Okay, I hear a heck of a lot about Japanese knotweed as well. And we see a lot of that along our county roads.
Yeah.
If you spot a patch of Japanese knotweed, what should you do about it?
Yeah, I mean, in Japanese knotweed, on my way here, I saw some beautiful stands of Japanese knotweed. It's blooming right now, so it's very, very evident out there. You can really see it. It's one of those invasives, again, that's pretty tough to control, but you have to be very, very careful with Japanese knotweed. What we usually recommend is regular cutting of the stems, but you have to bag those stems with black plastic, because the thing about Japanese knotweed and some other invasives too is it will sprout from the stems. And what's happened, one of the reasons the Japanese knotweed has spread so much is when we've had hurricanes or big storms and there's Japanese knotweed along a creek or water area, it will break off and go downstream and start new colonies. So if you're trying to control Japanese knotweed, we really recommend you cut on a regular basis, you bag it in black plastic, and just fry the heck out of it before you put it on, you know, anywhere in the compost heap or anything like that.
Should you even consider putting it on the compost heap?
No, I probably wouldn't put it on the compost heap, period. I just cut a bunch of Japanese still grass recently, and I put it in black plastic, and I'm just trying to figure out where to put it, actually, after it completely fries. So you probably wouldn't, because you might be spreading that around.
Well, we talked a little bit about Japanese stilt grass, mm-hmm. That, you know, it seems to be popping up all over the place, you know. A couple years ago, I would find a couple of instances, and now all of a sudden, it seems like it's all over. What does one do about it? You said it's an annual plant.
It is an annual, yeah.
So is it just a pulling issue, or is it, you know, mowing, or what is...
Well, one of the things, the reasons you're seeing Japanese stiltgrass, and I'm pretty convinced that the reason why I have it is because the lawnmower, the person who mows my lawn, had it on the tires of their lawnmower. So one of the things you really want to think about is prevention, first of all. Is cleaning your equipment, I mean, so you don't spread it around within your property. Or if you have someone who's mowing your lawn, you might want to ask them to spray off, hose off their tires before they bring it in. But then also, it is an annual, so the time of year to cut back Japanese stiltgrass is pretty much right now, end of August, beginning of September, before it goes to seed. You don't want to do it before that. Cut it back, and you can also put down pre-emergent herbicides in the spring so that they don't sprout back. But the issue with Japanese stiltgrass and many other invasives is it's not a one-year project. You have to cut it back now, so you'll get rid of those seeds, and then probably you're going to have to cut it back for the next couple of years, because the seeds stay viable in the ground for at least a couple of years to about 5 years.
And you said that it actually changes the chemistry of the soil. So does that mean that it'll be a couple of years before something else will grow?
Well, it really depends on how big of an infestation you have. But, I mean, if you're getting it in your woods, it probably will be a bit of time before the soil kind of comes back, because it puts chemicals into the soil. Yeah.
Okay. The other thing you notice when you're driving along, especially in some of the counties south of us, is there seems to be a lot of vines covering trees these days.
Yeah.
What are they, and is there a way we can prevent them from spreading north?
Yeah, I mean, I've seen that too. Certainly, I know, like in the Sawmill Parkway in Westchester, the trees are just covered with vines. And I'll tell you, it could be a number of things. It could be Asian bittersweet, which we have here as well, which is a very pernicious vine. And, you know, the way to deal with that is to cut it back on a regular basis. And sometimes we'll suggest that you paint the stems with that you've just cut with some herbicide, with some Roundup, something like that. But it may also be something called Mile-A-Minute, and that is something that has not quite gotten to Columbia and Greene counties yet, but we're really on the lookout for that, and you should be too as a listener. It's kind of an equilateral triangle, the leaf, and it has kind of thorns on it. You can find it on any website, but if you do see that, that's something you probably want to report to the Cooperative Extension or to your local DEC office, because that's something that is on its way up. And you asked about climate change as far as natives. Climate change for invasives is pretty bad news, because we're going to start seeing some invasives from south of here, like kudzu, which we don't have a lot of, but it's really bad in the south.
And the dreaded giant hogweed.
Yeah. It's kind of got, it's this infamous plant that is in the carrot family. It can grow to about 14 feet tall. It has this big white flower on top. We have had very, very limited sightings of that or instances of that in Columbia and Greene counties. But if you do think you have it, you want to be very, very careful because it can be very, very harmful. You talked about harmful invasive plants in the past. It's one that if you have any kind of contact with your skin, you can get very, very serious burns. So if you think you have that, I would report that. I would take a picture of it and report it to, or bring it into the cooperative extension, the picture of it. If you do think you've had contact with it, you want to wash your hand or the area that's affected very, very thoroughly, and then stay out of the sun for 48 hours. Because the sun, if you're in the sun and you've been exposed to it, you can get very, very serious burns.
Now, isn't this similar to the, what is it, water parsley that grows in ditches as well? Very similar.
It is, but I don't think you can get quite as serious of injuries from that. You certainly can get very, very intense skin irritation, but it's not quite as bad as
hogweed. Okay, because I have been getting reports from people who have been in contact with that.
Yeah,
it's like a baby cousin to the giant hogweed.
It's in the same family, I believe. Yeah, I think it's in the carrot family. You certainly want to be careful with that. It's just like poison ivy or anything else. But hogweed, actually, the people from the DEC, when they go out to eliminate hogweed, they have huge, basically hazmat suits on. Mm. So it's really, really serious.
So you're listening to Digging In with Master Gardeners from Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties. We're lucky to be talking with Master Gardener Tim Kenelty. You can reach Tim as well as other Master Gardeners by contacting Cornell Cooperative Extension at colgremg@cornell.edu or visiting our website at ccecolumbiagreen.org. So I understand that the spotted lanternfly has been found out west in Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
And it seems to lay its eggs on what's known as the tree of heaven. And we have a lot of that in Columbia and Greene counties.
Yeah.
So how does one control or eradicate it to prevent spotted lanternfly from showing up in New York?
But yeah, and Tree of Heaven is blooming right now, so it's really evident. It's one that you can really standing out in the landscape. We don't have, as far as I know, in Columbia or Greene, we don't really have an infestation of that particular insect. However, it is a very, very serious threat to our grape industry, our tree fruit industry. So if you think that you have seen that, and it's a very distinctive insect, it has red hind wings and kind of a yellow abdomen. It's a very, very distinct. If you think you have seen that, you want to take a picture of that. You want to take, if you can, a sample of that particular insect, put it in alcohol or freeze it and bring it into your cooperative extension, because we really want to know if there's any sightings of that particular insect in the area.
We actually had a phone report the other day from a trucker from Painted Post, which is near the Pennsylvania line.
Mm-hmm.
So people are being very clearly educated on it in the Pennsylvania
side. Yeah, I mean, it's something that, you know, you asked about if you're not a gardener. It's one of those things that if you can be someone, a sentinel for some of these things that are really, really serious potential risks to our agriculture and our ecosystems, it's a great thing to be able to, you know, be on the lookout for those things and report them.
So there's so many invasive plants out there. And, you know, this could be a very depressing topic if we let it. You mentioned that you can just Google what native plants are. Where do I go to find out what the invasive plants are in this area I should need to watch out for? And, you know, is there a way, certain things or apps I should be using to report them?
Yeah, I mean, and just to your point about it being depressing, I have given, you know, lectures on this, and people do get depressed. But, you know, the good news is that you really can, you can have an effect in your own landscape as in terms of reducing those plants. But there's lots and lots of resources. The DEC has a great website. Cooperative Extension has very good information. If you go onto our website, the Land Conservancy has some information on it. And there's an app that we haven't talked about yet called iNaturalist, which I use a lot. A lot of people are using. It's you take a picture of the plant. It has great photo recognition software, and it will give you possibilities of what that plant is. It's very, very accurate. So if you're out there and you have a smartphone, it's a free app to download. It's a great ID app. But I would also just say there's so much information out there on invasives from other states. If you think you have something, there's lots and lots of resources.
Yeah, iNaturalist is a great app.
Yeah.
It's, you know, helped me figure out what a lot of things I've had in my property.
Yeah, absolutely.
But there's also IMAP invasives that can be used. I believe that can be used to actually report.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, New York State is one of many states that that is part of a, it's basically a database. And if you are an IMAP invasive user, if you download the app, you can take a picture and basically report where you're seeing an invasive. So you have stilgrass on your property. You might want to take a picture of that. It actually shows the GPS coordinates of where it is. And it's really helping the DEC understand through citizen science kind of where the outbreaks of a lot of these invasives are and kind of where the concentration of them are. So it's really helpful if you want to do that, if you want to be a reporter, be a citizen scientist.
I understand there's organizations like PRISM and CRISP, as well as the DEC. What are their roles?
Mm-hmm. I think there's 8 PRISMs in the state, and they're basically kind of funded by the DEC. And they
What's a PRISM?
Okay. I have to think of what the abbreviation stands for. I don't have it down. It's a partnership for regional invasive species management, I think. And it's basically a group of people who are paid staff who do education. They go out and do outreach to communities. They also will do eradication if they see something, like if they saw a Milo Minute in Columbia County, they'd go out probably if it was reported and verify it and probably try to eradicate that particular outbreak so that we don't have it spread. But it's a great resource. And if you live in Columbia County, you're probably part of the Capital Mohawk PRISM. And CRISP is, if you're in Greene County or in counties kind of west of the Hudson. But they both have terrific websites and really, really good people. If you have any questions or if you find something that you think that you should be reporting, you can send it to them as well. They both have great websites and contact information on the websites.
So you just key CRISP or PRISM, and that will bring you to a nice cool website.
Yeah, okay. I mean, it's a quick Google search.
And for others among us who are elderly and feeble on the internet, you can casually say to use, to Google something or look something up. But a little caveat on that, there's a lot of junk on the internet as well.
Yeah.
I usually recommend that people look at, for information on specific plants, land grant colleges. Mm-hmm. So if they see a state university as one of their choices on that Google list to go into there, you can verify very readily that it's a land grant college, which is what Cornell is.
Mm-hmm.
And that they make those couple of first steps so that they don't end up with a lot of misguided.
Yeah, and I think it's a great point, Jean, because University of Pennsylvania has a great site, and if there are invasives that are kind of started in the Midwest, some of the Midwest states have really, really good land-grant college sites as well.
Some of our listeners live in areas where they don't have good cell service or internet service. That's where they could also contact the Master Gardeners, and we can also help in identifying the if the plant is an invasive species, as well as reporting it to the DEC and other organizations.
Yeah, I know a lot of people bring in plant samples and insect samples, and we've been mostly talking about plants, but there are a lot of invasive insects as well into the Cooperative Extension offices, and it's a really great way of kind of finding out what's happening. It's a great resource.
And we Master Gardeners learn as much as the clientele who bring in these mysteries.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's a lot of fun trying to be detective to figure it all out. So, this can all be quite overwhelming to the average listener. But if I'm a landowner and I recognize that I've got some invasive species on my land, what do I do? What's the first step?
I think the first step is just educating yourself and doing a little bit of research, really understanding whether you have a small parcel of land or 100 acres, kind of what's on your land. I mean, you probably have some beautiful native plants, but you probably have some invasives too. So educating yourself and understanding what you have. And if you do have invasives, really trying to, get there very early. So if you have a little tiny bit of Japanese stilgrass, you're going to have a lot in a couple of years. So you really want to try to get there as early as possible. Early detection and understanding what the plant is and how to deal with it. And each of them has their own kind of management method, and all of that's on the internet.
And one of the things that I've been reading is that Bradford pears are starting to show up in the forest, and honeysuckle is starting to show up in the forest. You reach a point where if you've got the larger parcels, they're a lot harder to manage.
That's right, yeah.
In that case, it's just a matter of going through and cutting, them down and using glyphosate to paint the stems? Or is it, you know, any suggestions for those?
I think the suggestion is to take a big, deep breath. I mean, I have 13 acres, and I really wasn't aware of invasive plants till about 5 years ago. So I feel kind of badly that I let some of this go. But I have big, big honeysuckle shrubs, and I have big autumn olives. And what I do is I go out in the fall, and I cut them all back. I go out in the spring and cut them all back as much as possible. But to know you're not going to over-eradicate these things. If you can control them, that's great, because what you will find is if you cut down a big honeysuckle shrub next spring, you're going to see native plants springing up, coming out, you know, that it has been shading. You're going to see new native plants coming up. So you can really make a difference.
So do you suggest a plant inventory of your property?
Yeah, I mean, I what I would say is that you don't want to, you know, bite too much off. I would say maybe you do a plant inventory of a part of your property. Mm-hmm. And I have had my property for over 30 years, and I'm still discovering things. I mean, I just found a big, big black walnut tree growing up in an area beside my driveway, which I had never seen before.
They hide well.
They do, those nasty black walnuts. But I mean, basically, it's just kind of learning what you have. And if you see something that's really taking over or that looks really healthy, it might be an invasive plant. You probably want to take a look at it.
So I'm hearing you say cut down and pull out and remove. I don't hear you mentioning nuking things, which is what everybody wants to hear. They want to hear about the herbicide that's going to just knock it out and resolve the whole thing.
Yeah, and you know, as master gardeners, we're pretty careful about recommending herbicides. I would say on native, or not native, on non-native invasive shrubs like the big honeysuckles and things like that, I would use herbicide. This is what I do in the fall when the nutrients are going down into the roots of the plant. I cut the plant down to the ground, and I will immediately paint that cut with glyphosate, and it will take that glyphosate down into the ground. That's probably the most effective way of doing that. Now, a lot of people don't want to use herbicides at all, and that's absolutely fine, and then you just basically keep cutting. But that's one way to use it. I wouldn't go crazy spraying, and if you have a very, very, if you have a very, very small outbreak of say stiltgrass, when we keep going back to stiltgrass, I have it too. One of the things that you can use that is not a chemical herbicide is really high concentration vinegar. I've been using that lately. You can get it on Amazon.com or any place else. And it's very effective in killing a lot of perennials, invasive perennials or annuals like stiltgrass.
What about the corn gluten? You see that available on the market.
Yeah, we're actually going to do some research on stiltgrass and corn gluten at the Cooperative Extension office in Hudson. It's a pre-emergent product. So you'd put it down in where you know that you have stiltgrass or something like that. In the area that you have that in April-ish before the seeds start sprouting. And we're going to see if that works because, it's kind of an organic solution to that. My understanding is you have to apply a lot of it. So maybe we'll come back and talk about that once we've done our experiments.
That's one of the nice things about being a master gardener is that we try to offer science-based information, things that have been tested, that have been proven, as opposed to the anecdotal information that often you find on, you know, say Pinterest and other sites, because the reality is some of that information simply isn't effective.
Yeah, absolutely.
In addition to being a master gardener, I understand you're also a master naturalist. So what does that mean? And, you know, what's involved in the training? And what do you do as a master naturalist?
Yeah, that's a great question. I am a master naturalist. It's also in New York State. It's a group of people that are trained by Cornell University. They have a program. You go to Ithaca for a couple of days with like-minded people, and they have great educators there who basically teach you about beyond gardening. It's really about wildlife habitat, it's about birds, insects, plants, and it's about really caring for nature. And it's a great program. It's a very competitive program to get into, but I would highly recommend it. It's basically a volunteer program.
Is how long have you been a master naturalist?
I've been a master naturalist, I think, 2 years. And really, once you've taken the training, what you do is you continue to take courses and learn. And also, most master naturalists get involved in some kind of project. So anything from bird counts, bird surveys, to looking at deer exclosures and how that affects native plants, to doing work on restoring native plant areas, to reducing invasive plants. There's all kinds of projects out there, and people are doing all kinds of neat things.
So I'm curious, what got you into becoming a master naturalist?
Well, I just spent all my time outside when I was a kid, and I loved animals and frogs and, you know, toads and all those things. So when I stopped working, I thought it would be a great thing to get involved with.
Do you have a particular project you're working on now as a master naturalist?
I do. I'm working on a couple of things. I talked about that siltgrass experiment, but also I've been working for a couple of years. I'm involved with the Columbia Land Conservancy. I'm a volunteer there. And let me talk a little bit about the Land Conservancy just for a minute, because it's a great organization. Their real focus is, and I'm a trustee there now too, their real focus is preserving the farmlands, forests, native habitat of Columbia County. And it's a great organization, and they have, besides doing all kinds of great things for the environment, they also own more than 3,000 acres of land, public conservation areas. So if you're in Columbia County, there's a public conservation area near you, there's 10, and they have trails. It's a really great way to get out, get in touch with nature. You can walk your dog there. I was just at Overmountain Conservation Area yesterday. It's a beautiful, beautiful 1,700-acre site, just a beautiful place with all kinds of grassland birds and unique habitats. So I really encourage people to go out and check out the conservation areas. But I do have a project at one of the conservation areas, Siegel Klein Kill in the town of Ghent. It's a small parcel of land, probably 55 acres. And another master gardener and I were walking around, and we said there's so much invasive plant material here, so many Japanese honeysuckle shrubs. What could we do about this? And it was kind of former farmland, so they had just taken over. So we went to the Land Conservancy, it's before I was a trustee and when I was just a volunteer, and said, like, what can we do? Can we get some other volunteers to cut some of this back? And we did. And we have a huge group of volunteers now who are working on this. Really, really interesting, fun people to work with. And we've cut back huge swaths of Japanese honeysuckle, and we've gotten grants to plant native trees and shrubs in their place. And just last year, we got grants to plant a big native wildflower garden, about an acre in size, last December, and all that's sprouting up now. So I guess my message here is, like, if you want to do things like this, it's just about you thinking about what you can do and talking to an organization, and you can really make a difference. I think that the volunteers for the Land Conservancy really feel like they come out for a couple of hours and do some work, and they're, even if they don't have their own property, they're really making a difference in the environment.
Is Columbia County an outlier in this movement, or are there other counties doing similar things?
No, there's lots of land trusts in the United States. Columbia County's Land Conservancy is a really good organization. It has really done a great job in terms of preserving land, but also really looking at invasives now and how they can manage their land and really be models for gardeners and other land conservancies in terms of making sure that invasives aren't taking over. And we're doing, as I said, we're doing some restoration too, and we're looking at all kinds of other projects now. We do a lot of education too, as far as invasives and native plants too, for landowners. So there's a lot of it across the country, but Columbia County's got an especially good organization.
We're talking with Master Gardener Tim Kenelty on Digging In with Master Gardeners from Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties. You can contact Cornell Cooperative Extension at ccecolumbiagreen.org or email at us at colgremg@cornell.edu. So you really are involved with the Land Conservancy in Columbia County. What are the other properties that people could go visit in order to enjoy?
There's 10 different PCAs in Columbia County, and they're all on their website, and there's a description of each of them on the website. But there's PCAs in the southern part of the county, through the middle of the county, and the top. So wherever you live in Columbia County, or even if you live across the river, you've got one that's pretty close to you. And There are, as I said, there's descriptions on the website. So if you're interested in a particular type of animal or something like that, like ooms up in the north, has a lot of grassland birds, these open areas of grasslands where grassland birds like bobolinks, and they're starting to fly south now, but you can't see them anywhere else. They're just amazing areas, ecosystems that have very, very specific, plants, animals, birds. So I would say just take a look at the website and go out, and you can take your dog there as long as your dog's leashed. It's a great place to go. I would recommend Over Mountain too, which is just this beautiful, beautiful site.
So as a member of, being a master gardener and in a master naturalist, you really can bring a lot of skills to the Land Conservancy. What was involved in the training to become a naturalist?
Well, as I said, there's a 2.5 or 3 day session at the Arno Forest outside of Ithaca, and it's all Cornell educators, people who work at Cornell, who are specialists in. I mean, there was a topic on bird. There's a bird lecture. There was a mammal lecture. There were people who came in and talked about insects. So it's a fairly rigorous 2.5 days, and then really the expectation is that you continue to, take trainings, and they are constantly sending us information about trainings across the county. And you'd be surprised how many different programs there are in our area, in Columbia County, in Greene County, in the Berkshires. If you, kind of just look around, there's lots and lots of different programs. We're really fortunate to have all the programs that we do.
So becoming both a master gardener and master naturalist is more than just volunteering your services. You do need to go through the training, and you need to be willing to give back to the community with what you've learned.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. But I mean, I think most people who take the training, they really want to do that. And I've read about, we get emails about other master naturalists across the state and all the great projects they're working on, bird projects and monitoring projects and phenology projects. And so it's usually educators, people who are school teachers, or people who are working with land trusts, or people who are just, like us gardeners who are really interested in ecology. And the people are very, very interested who came to the training and really wanted to do more projects, I think.
And as an equal opportunity mentioner, Tim is in the Columbia County District. Greene County has many of these kind of activities going on. The Siusla Forest across from our offices up in Acre is an educational forest. There's teaching going on in there all the time. It's spelled Siuslaw, if you want to look into that a little bit. And there's a preserve at the Embot in Catskill where you can go hiking, you can take canoes. There are
kayaks.
There are kayaks there, and you can kayak through swampland and borderline, and I guess that's partially salt marsh. I'm not too up on that, but there are a lot of opportunities in both counties that are just not available anywhere else. So it's definitely to your advantage to check with maybe DEC for the big picture of what's available in either county.
Yeah, we're really fortunate to live in this area. It's an amazing, amazing area. It's a beautiful, beautiful area, and lots of kind of untouched parts of both counties.
So for our listeners who want to learn more and get more involved, what should they do? Are there specific websites to go to or organizations to contact?
Yeah, I think we've mentioned most of them. Certainly Cooperative Extension. We have our own Columbia Green website. If you're interested in kind of knowing about native plants, there's lots of websites out there. There's lots and lots of books on native plants. As far as invasives, I would check out your PRISM sites. The DEC has really, really good specific information about invasives. And as I said, there's almost no way that you can go wrong if you start Googling a particular invasive plant. You're going to get a lot of information.
We have other angles coming up in future shows. One of the things we're going to be talking about is native pests, as in poison ivy, mm-hmm. and even the Virginia creeper can become mm-hmm. a pest. So there are a lot of things that, it must be an invasive because it's eating my yard, is not necessarily correct language for it.
Yeah,
so we'll have.
Yeah, I differentiate. I say like grapevine is also have a lot of really native grapevine, but that is very, very. I call them aggressive plants and instead of invasive plants if they're native.
Yeah.
But yeah, they can be very aggressive and they can pull down trees and,
yep.
you know.
Yeah. And we're going to be getting into a discussion of the difference between native and invasive mm-hmm. insect and animal pests.
But I think as a preview for that future show, I understand that you also have a lot of experience with jumping worms, which is an example of a native pest.
I think that's a whole show in itself, Teresa. Yeah, I mean, there's kind of a couple of different categories of invasives. We've talked mostly about terrestrial plants. There's aquatic plants. There are terrestrial animals like the jumping worm, and there's insects. There's a whole group of insect pests. Like the emerald ash borer, which is doing a huge, huge amount of damage to our ash crop. But yeah, the jumping worm is an earthworm that is from Asia, and it has been very, very destructive. And we're hearing a lot of reports about it. It really does a number on our soil, and they spread very rapidly. And there's information, I think, on our website about jumping worms. But yeah, it's definitely one that is a potentially really, really harmful pest.
So we'll be covering a lot more of that in a future program. So stewards of this planet, we have many beautiful options for planting native ground covers, perennials, shrubs, vines, and trees. Native plants are a food source for people, pollinators, and wildlife alike. We hope that you've learned a bit more about native plants, non-native ones, and invasive plants. By focusing on the native varieties, we can help to ensure the balance within our ecosystems. So thank you very much for joining us. A very special thank you for Tim Kenelty as our guest today. Stay tuned for future editions of Digging In with Master Gardeners. In the interim, you can contact Cornell Cooperative Extension at ccecolumbiagreen.org or email us at colgremg@cornell.edu.
You can contact Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties with questions at ccecolumbiagreen.org, visit us in Hudson or in Acre, or ask us questions on the Master Gardeners of CCE Columbia and Greene Counties Facebook group. Cornell Cooperative Extension provides equal program and employment opportunities. From below till the rains come tumbling.